May it please the court. On behalf of the appellant, my name is Britt Clayton, registration number 15940, with the firm of Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite. This case is unprecedented in the sense that it poses an issue not addressed in the prior precedents of the Colorado courts. But this case is unprecedented in other respects, too. We have here a county assessor and a representative of the State Division of Property Taxation, DPT, testifying that their valuation methodology does not attempt to determine what a willing buyer would pay a willing seller for this property, which has been the legal standard of actual valuation for property tax purposes for at least 25 years in this state. We have the county assessor and the DPT making assumptions in their financial models that are contradictory to the known and undisputed facts and that are internally self-contradictory. And without citation to a single legal authority supporting such an extraordinary methodology, the Board of Assessment Appeals approves the methodology. This case is truly unprecedented at every level. The county attempts to justify this highly unusual, if not illegal, approach to valuation on the ground that the 547 members of the golf club had each carted off with them taxable interests in the land, leaving the property owner, my client, with less than the fee simple absolute. In order to capture and tax these missing interests in the land, the argument goes, we have to disregard the willing buyer, willing seller definition of actual value, and we have to indulge the false and self-contradictory financial assumptions embodied in the DPT methodology.
Pardon me, counsel.
Yes.
Before we get to the issue, though, of actual value, you have raised a preliminary issue, which is whether the membership interests are taxable property interests.
Yes.
Would you go ahead and address that first, please?
I will. There are two paths laid out in our briefs to address the merits of whether the memberships in this case are interests in land within the meaning of the tax of the real property definition 39.1.102.14. One path is to apply traditional common law property concepts concerning what is an interest in land and what is not. An alternative path is to apply Colorado case law and statutes developed in the specific context of the taxation of possessory interests in real property, namely the Vail case and section 39.1.103.17. Both of these paths lead to the same result. With regard to the first path, traditional real property concepts, we submit that the phrase, stick in the bundle of rights, should be banished from our collective vocabulary in this case because it is hopelessly ill-defined, imprecise, and non-statutory. In defining taxable real property rights in section 102.14, the General Assembly used the phrase lands and interests in lands. They no doubt use the term interest in lands because that concept has been well developed over centuries of case law dating back to English common law. There is an ample body of law enabling one to clearly understand what is or is not an interest in land, and that law is cited in our briefs. The General Assembly did not define taxable real property as a stick in the bundle of rights. The stick in the bundle is a useful concept for teaching first year property law in law school, and the phrase occasionally pops up euphemistically in the case law, but it has no precise meaning. It is not a phrase used by the courts in defining the attributes of property rights or property interests.
Pardon me again, but let me focus your argument a little bit more. In talking about the unit assessment rule, that talks about a leasehold and whether a leasehold can be part of the fee for purposes of property taxation. Would you address the issue of whether these memberships are a leasehold for that purpose.
Yes. And just to reorient on the unit assessment rule, what it says is that when there are multiple interests, taxable interests, in a piece of real property, they shall all be included in one assessment to the record title owner. We're not going to send a tax bill to the lessee and a tax bill to the landlord. The unit assessment rule does not dictate or address in any fashion what is a taxable interest in land. There are a number of interests in land which have been posited by the county. One of them is a lease. This is not a lease for the reasons expressed in our reply brief. A lease gives the tenant an exclusive right to possess and control the property to the exclusion of the landlord. We certainly don't have that here. We have a very limited license-like rights to use the property at limited times in limited ways, all under the omnipresence and control of the landlord. We have no ability in these club members to exclude others from the property or to make exclusive use of the property for their own purposes.
So our focus then should be on the membership agreement, right? And what that has to say?
That is the defining instrument that establishes what these club memberships are. There's some gloss that has been put on in the testimony about the economics of golf courses and how it works in real life, but ultimately, as in many, if not all, commercial settings, parties are allowed to determine what shall be our relationship by a written instrument between them.
I guess now you can save some time for rebuttal if you wish.
I would, thank you. Your Honor, did I address your question?
Yes, you did, thank you.
Again, I would vigorously encourage this court to eschew the very nebulous concept of bundle of sticks in the bundle of rights here. This is the concept that the DPT urged upon the board as the explanation for this unheard of methodology, is that sticks in the bundle have escaped. This is the language that the board itself used in explaining why it was approving this methodology, that sticks in the bundle have escaped. But this is not the language of real property interests and rights as it has evolved. There's no definition in the case law of what is a stick. This is a vague, colloquial concept that somehow in this case took on a life of its own and justified a conclusion that can't be justified under normal concepts of property valuation, nor can it be justified under the common law of real property rights and interests. The question for this court is, as Your Honor pointed out, are these club memberships interests in land under the statute with which we must operate? So the common law path to answer that question leads to the answer, no. It's not a lease, it's not an easement, it's not anything that has ever been recognized in the common law as an interest in real property. End of story, end of analysis on that path. The other path is the Vail case and section 103.17. We submit that these authorities actually provide a more nuanced and directly applicable analysis of the issue presented. The county does not dispute that if these authorities apply, then these club memberships cannot be taxable interests in land. Two of the three Vail factors are missing here. No ability for the members to generate revenues on the property and no ability to exclude others.
But pardon me again, Kelsa, I'm sorry to be interrupting you so much.
I enjoyed the interruptions, thank you.
Isn't the Vail case a little bit more difficult to apply here than the common law approach that you previously talked about because of the fact that it and the Mesa Verde cases come from a standard where the principal interest is not taxable, like the U.S. government. And as a result, the Supreme Court was having to wrestle with a fairly complicated issue about, well, we cannot tax the federal government's interest, but should we be able to tax the interest of these concessionaires or these people who are using the property? So
So doesn't that present an issue that we really don't have here?
Well, certainly the context is different, but one of the hallmarks of legal reasoning is appreciating when the rationale of one case applies equally well and appropriately to another case. And we submit that it does here, despite the different context. There are three reasons for that. First, Vail was concerned with the exact issue presented here, albeit in a different context, but the same substantive issue, whether certain rights in real property rose to the level of an interest in land under Section 10214. The Vail court held when interests under the three-part Vail standard, when an interest rises to that level, it may be taxed and therefore it must be taxed. And that is precisely the circle of issues that we have here. Vail holds that it's constitutionally impermissible to discriminate among classes of these interests, absent a constitutional basis to do so. And hence, the fact that there's a different owner underlying this possessory or claim possessory interest should not matter to the determination. I'll put it this way. If this golf course was federally owned, there's no question that these membership interests would not be taxable under Vail or Section 10317. The fact that the course is owned by a private owner rather than the federal government should not make a difference under the very principles discussed in Vail and under the equal protection principles that we have discussed in our briefs. What the unit assessment rule does to bring this sort of full circle is say, if there are two interests, and the fee owner is a private entity, the assessor values both of those interests and sends one bill to the private entity. If there are two interests and the fee holder is the federal government, you can't assess them, just send the bill for the possessory interest to the owner of that interest. As the cases we have cited indicate, the unit assessment rule really only addresses who receives the tax bill, not the question of what is a taxable interest in land. Thank you. I will reserve my last few minutes.
May it please the court, Laura Maker, attorney registration number 41385. Representing the Board of Pitkin County Board of Equalization. As an initial matter, I have to apologize for my tardiness to both the court and Mr. Clayton. I was directed to a different courtroom. Pitkin County requests this court uphold the Board of Assessment Appeals determination that previously sold non-equity golf club memberships are taxable real property, and thus we request that you uphold the valuation of $19 million for tax purposes. The Board of Assessment Appeals determination is correct because these previously sold golf club non-equity memberships are not a mere license, as the Roaring Fork Club suggests. They are a usable interest in the real property, and thus, under the Colorado Constitution, must be taxed. There's no exemption here.
What's the difference between a usable interest and a license?
So a license allows the grantor of the license to revoke the license. It's simply a bare interest in the property. Whereas here, the Roaring Fork Club has granted specific, tangible, usable rights to the membership holders. They have the right to use the property for the entirety of their life. There's a right of survivorship in the spouse. A new owner of the property is required to recognize the rights previously granted. It does not simply end when a new owner takes over the property.
Oh, pardon me, counsel, but doesn't the membership agreement provide that it is revocable?
Yes, but simply stating that so doesn't make it so. One can say it's revocable, but there has to be specific ways that it's revoked.
Is it revocable for non-payment of dues?
Yes, Your Honor. However, if there is payment of dues, it can't simply be revoked. The membership here grants specific rights that are not just able to disappear at the whim of the owner of the Roaring Fork Club.
You would agree that we should look to the membership agreement to determine what this interest is, right?
As well as what has been conveyed in that membership agreement, yes.
And the membership agreement is pretty specific and pretty detailed in saying it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. There is no ownership interest here. And it goes through a really long series of it's nots, right?
Correct.
In light of all those it's nots, how is this possibly interesting?
Well, the Supreme Court in Mesa Verde has recognized, Mesa Verde 1 has recognized a usufruct, for example, as a specific interest in property. This is the closest, I believe, to what is at issue here.
Did you argue that this was a usufruct to the down below?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically in document 47, the respondent's closing, page 2, paragraph 4. And this was also recognized by the Roaring Fork Club today in an additional filing. The specific property rights in the nature of a usufructory interest that are granted by membership include exclusive access to private facility with many recreational benefits, rights for life with survivorship for the member's spouse, the right to access the property without the general public being able to access it at the same time, the right of the member to allow guests to access the property, and the right of first offer to purchase the club from a previous owner. Those are specific tangible rights that don't just disappear in the way that a license allows rights to disappear. Whether you call it a usufruct or whether you call it a leasehold, the idea is that in the common law, you get the bundle of rights, the right to exclude other people, the right to sell property, the right to rent property, and those specific sticks in that bundle of rights comprise the property as a whole. If you take one of those sticks out, you aren't looking at the entirety of the property. And that's the reason we speak about these specific sticks in the bundle of rights. Because when you look at property, it can be very difficult to understand what that intangible thing is. It's the sum of its parts. You never hear someone say, the whole is less than the sum of the parts, because it doesn't make sense. The same holds true in property. You don't value an entire property if you don't look at all of the parts of that property. By conveying these rights in exchange for initial deposits of over $54 million, the Roaring Fork Club has transferred a portion of the totality of its interest in real property. The initial deposits are similar to large upfront lease payments. Without the initial deposits, the club would have been unable to develop the property, it likely wouldn't have been built, or it would be necessary for annual memberships to dues to be much greater to sustain the property. Further, the Roaring Fork Club concedes that unsold memberships are specific property interests, one of the sticks in the bundles of rights. They completely treat unsold membership interests and sold membership interests completely different. That's intellectually dishonest. It just doesn't work. The best method for valuing the fee simple interest of this property is to value the property as though it were unencumbered. To value it as unencumbered, one needs to look at what existed prior to the conveyance of interest with membership. The method to do that is to consider the sale of all potential memberships. This is what the Division of Property Taxation analysis properly does to value the property. Turning to arguments made by the Roaring Fork Club, CRS 39-1-103-17A-2 applies to exempt property. The statute Part A specifically states that the valuation of possessory interest in exempt properties is uncertain, and that the following standards outlined later in the statute apply to that exempt property. Now, the reason for this is there's something inherently different about property owned by the government than property owned by an individual. And that comes down to the nature of the property. When you think about government property, people are typically not excluded from that property, unlike private property. The concept of trespassing is applied much more commonly in the private property context than in the public property context. And that's based on the fact that the public, in theory, owns government property and should have the right of use. That is completely untrue in the context of private property. And that's why the legislature has chosen to differentiate and explicitly discuss how exempt property must meet different criteria. And I mean different criteria in that specific things must be evaluated.
If this were a public golf course, would you be here?
Well, it depends.
Well, wouldn't the Vail rule, if this were a public golf course, wouldn't the Vail rule say that, wouldn't that work in the membership's favor?
I think it would. When you look at public property, such as Forest Service land, there are specific instances where the Forest Service grants special use permits that allow certain people to use particular portions of the land, sometimes to the exclusion of other people. But it can always be revoked in a way that the membership agreement here does not allow the Roaring Fork Club to revoke those property interests. So there's something very specific about private property that doesn't require, by the legislature, one to look at it on these specific levels.
If a landowner sold for substantial value a license to enter onto the land for big game hunting, would that be taxable interest?
It would not if it was specifically a license.
Well, I didn't mean to trap you by using the legal term. If the transaction was for $10,000 a year, you can come on my land and hunt elk.
Well, it depends on what is actually given. Is it you can just come on the land, but you don't have any additional interest, you don't have the right to invite others on the land, you don't have the right to pass that interest on to someone else. If someone who owns the property, who granted you that interest or license, conveys the property, will you still have the ability to use that? Those are the types of considerations that need to go on to determine if it's a license or if it's a more substantial possessory interest, such as a usufruct or a leasehold.
Thank you.
Any other further questions? Thank you.
Last night in reviewing materials, I noted that I had made a misstatement in our reply brief about the county not having raised the concept of usufruct previously. And this morning I filed an errata to the reply brief. I wanted to bring that to the attention of the court and apologize to Ms. McCarr for my misstatement. Ms. McCarr said that taxpayers being intellectually dishonest in treating unsold memberships as property interests, yet not sold membership interests. That is not true. We treat unsold memberships as a potential source of future revenue to the property owner. It is a traditional, well-accepted, and DPT-accepted proposition that future revenues brought to present value by discounting your capitalization computation are an appropriate and intrinsic part of the property being valued. We're not saying that those future membership interests, that the membership's not yet sold, are taxable interests in land. We are saying they are future revenues properly included under the most traditional evaluation models.
Council, pardon me, why isn't this just a taxable usufructory interest then?
A usufruct is a right to derive profits from property, and profits is a broad term that can mean natural profits or monetary profits from land, involving no interest therein. In our reply brief, we have quite an extensive discussion of usufructs, where they came from, what they are, and the fact that they are not interests in land. The ability to derive, to go onto somebody's land and pick fruit or hunt or conduct some other gathering activity, or to have a concession cart, or any number of other profit-making gathering activities on someone's property, is a usufruct. It's not a proper interest in land, and importantly, these members have no right to do any of that. They are prohibited from soliciting business. They're prohibited from doing anything except golfing, swimming, fishing. They can't even dress the way they want. It's such a controlled environment.
Under what circumstances, other than non-payment of dues, does the membership agreement allow the membership to be terminated?
By the club, as opposed to by the
sure.
member. To my recollection, non-payment of dues is the only one. I may stand corrected on the sort of flagrant, repeated violations of the rules of a person would become persona non grata, but I can't say that for a fact.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I do not know the complete answer to that question.
Okay.
I see my time is up. I thank you kindly for your time.
We thank counsel for the argument. We apologize if you were directed to the wrong location. The case stands submitted.